Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 78. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking, like many before us, about Steve Jobs. So I hope you have your iPad, your iPhone, your iPod, your iMac, your Mac Air, or your MacBook, or whatever else that you have tuned in to listen to first-time guest, hopefully multiple-time guest in the future, Jason Myers, and Joe Darnell, host of the Tectonic podcast, here to talk all things Apple and all things Steve Jobs. And now, like we mentioned, this is not the first Steve Jobs biopic, so we kind of have to ask ourselves, what makes this one different? Why do we need to do it again? What kind of story did director Danny Boyle and writer Aaron Sorkin, who many of us really enjoy, have to tell that they needed to go grab Michael Fassbender and Kate Winslet and Seth Rogen and Jeff Daniels and on and on and on and tell this different view of Steve Jobs' life? Well, we get to see three chapters dramatized to give us an idea of who Jobs was and what makes him different. Critics are mostly buying it, and even our panel isn't completely bought in. So we have all the makings for a great discussion, and it's really, really good. So make sure you guys are checking out realworldtheology.com. You're going to find all kinds of great stuff there, new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, podcasts, all that stuff. Follow us on Facebook at Real World Theology. Follow us on Twitter at Real World Theo. Subscribe to the podcast. You can do that through all kinds of different ways, through FeedBurner, Stitcher, iTunes. And guys, we have so many good podcasts coming up. We've already got Bridge of Spies, The Good Dinosaur, Spectre, Mockingjay Part 2, all lined up. And you can look for those on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of each month. We also are working on our Christmas special, our Star Wars minisodes. So that's right around the corner. So if you're enjoying what we're doing here, rate and review the show. Tell your friends. Let us know what you loved about the conversation. And hey, join in the conversation. That's why we do this. More feedback, more people, better discussions. So again, we have a really, really great show for you. It's a really good movie. Here it is, episode 78, Steve Jobs and Losing Control. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Well, I'm guessing that you would have no hesitations taking any of your children to see Steve Jobs.
No, of course. They watch all the keynote presentations on my Apple TV with me. This is nothing. They're used to this stuff. This is standard issue.
Well, I kind of had this picture, especially after you described pre-show that you were babysitting them currently by watching Goblet of Fire.
Yeah.
And so I imagine like the keynote coming on and all your children are like watching some type of movie, and you come in and you just grab the controller and turn the movie off. You're like Apple's on the TV.
We got more important things to watch.
Listen, kids, gotta train you in the ways.
Make memories later.
That's right. Yeah. And watching all the keynotes.
Yeah, the kids are actually surrounded by Apple products. They grew up with an iMac as the television, because when we got married, we had a small home and we didn't have a regular TV. We started using Hulu and Netflix right in the living room. And in our small home, I bought a 27-inch iMac, and that was the TV. So my daughter started using trackpads and magic mice and stuff right at the very beginning. Yeah. And then it didn't take any time at all before I was handing down my iPads and buying new ones. I was giving them the old ones, and the kids were touching, the iPads all days of the week, playing games. And they just were immersed in this world with this Apple technology stuff. They've never used a PC of any kind. They haven't used an Android of any kind.
Not even at school.
They've never seen one boot up. They've never seen one open a program.
What a beautiful world that you have.
It's a very special walled garden.
Yeah, every day they come home to the temple of Jobs.
Exactly.
At House Darnell.
Oh yeah, the Wi-Fi network in the house is named what is it called? The Apple TV is named Fortress of Appletude.
Nice.
Yeah, so if you're trying to connect to the Apple TV with any of the computers to share your media, it's to connect to the fortress of Appletude. Yeah.
See, I did that for my at-home network at our house, and so we used to share internet with our neighbors, mm-hmm. and they all used PCs, so I made the password to our guest network Steve Jobs, so that each time they wanted to log in, they'd have to at least acknowledge his presence. And so it was a very subtle, like, dig.
So when did that happen for you, Jason? When did the Apple switch happen?
I got bit by the Apple bug in roughly 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I bought my first MacBook. And it was...
So what spurred it on?
I had a friend who was a lifelong Apple enthusiast. Mm-hmm. Max, his dad always bought Macs. Mm-hmm. And I was still in the doldrums of the PC world trying to figure out how I was going to, you know, get the next big thing. And he said, why don't you think about an Apple? And... You know, and so I bit the bug and went for it, and it was a slippery slope ever since. So I've just surrounded myself.
So maybe it's like podcasting. You do it one time, and then you got to have the next one and the next one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they don't make it easy to not, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's very easy to
everything kind of needs to be together and look all the same. And
mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So I just kept adding there from MacBooks to an iPhone to an iPad to I just actually got a brand new 27-inch iMac that I'm loving. Retina iMac, and it's gorgeous.
And you're sporting the Apple Watch?
I have the Apple Watch, yep. And I have pretty much the whole ecosystem going on.
All right, so Joe, are you Apple Watched?
Yes, I am. I'm wearing one of the steel Apple Watches. The 42.
Yeah. I'm always seeing you tweet. You're probably tweeting from your watch.
No, I only did that once.
Just to say I did.
like you kind of say it like something like you did in high school that you didn't really mean to do.
I did it once,
you know. I was just experimenting with the Apple Watch.
Just back in May. Just May.
Oh. Yeah. So are both you guys... Well, okay, so at my job, mm-hmm. I am... Well, not totally anymore because a couple other people have come on board. But at one point, no one knew how to work on Macs. Mm-hmm. And we started getting some users who were using Macs. On a kind of on and off basis, and they wouldn't pay to send us to training. They wouldn't, you know, they didn't technically say they supported it. They were kind of like, you know, doing the hands over the ears. No, don't want to hear about it. And I said, look, we have users that have these problems. We honestly have no idea. Like none of the techs, none of us use Macs at home. If you get me one, I'll learn how to do it on my own. And when they call, I'll just send them all to me. And so that's how I got my first MacBook Pro.
There you go.
And I had maybe 4 months prior finished building my custom PC.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. You know, my extra slot, my dual video card. You know, I had 16 gigs of RAM. And this is like three years ago.
It's all open.
And it's open. And I loved it. And it was beautiful. I was running my dual monitors at mm-hmm. super high resolutions. It's the fastest mm-hmm. thing I'd ever, you know, it had lights and it was beautiful. And I used my Mac for probably 3 or 4 months before I stopped using my other computer.
Nice.
And it's what I'm on now. I mean, not the same Mac. Yeah. I can't not do. It goes everywhere with me.
Yeah.
So I'm addicted. I'm worshiping it to my as well. You know, sadly, but so that's why I knew that at least the three of us.
Yeah.
Probably hopefully lots more because of the buzz it's getting. Mm-hmm. We're all going to go see Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. We're going to go see this movie. We're very interested in it. We're interested to see what the story behind the person who has pushed, not necessarily specifically created, mm-hmm. but pushed these things that are infiltrating culture. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of what happens typically on this podcast mm-hmm. is that we get to talk about a movie that is engaging with culture or kind of intrinsically filling the cracks of culture all around us. But this actually serves two purposes because this one is about the thing that is now the hip thing mm-hmm. in culture. Like if you don't go get the new Apple thing, then you are either poor, a person of bad taste
or really dumb
or you just don't even know what's going on.
Exactly.
You know, so like this is the mm-hmm. thing to have. If you're not supporting Apple or working towards Apple in some way.
Apple.
So, I mean, like seriously, like, and so I'm overselling it maybe a little bit, but I don't think I'm that far off.
No, I mean, I do have this idea where you see people, you know, without Apple products and you're mm-hmm. like, okay, is it a financial reason? Or is it just ignorance? Because one is just so, I mean, I just I can deal with one better than the other.
Okay, so you can do this in another way. Like, if Joe, so you go to a coffee shop, okay?
Yes.
And you see someone on a normal laptop, or a Dell laptop, or, you know, HP, Lenovo, whatever. You see them on a normal laptop, and then you see the person sitting next to them on an Apple.
Mm-hmm.
You probably get a little judgy. You give in to some stereotypes.
Yes, just a little bit, maybe. Yeah.
And you say, obviously, the person with the podcast is probably someone of superior intellect. They're probably like an artist. They're probably doing some kind of graphic design. They're probably writing a book. Yeah. They're probably a writer. Or the pinnacle of all art. They're probably like a podcaster doing some show notes.
That's right.
You know? So, but the other person, oh, it's probably some poor student. Mm-hmm. It was like a hand-me-down.
Exactly. That or a salesman.
Or, you know, like they're having to run Office, but they don't know that they can run that on a Mac. You know, they're probably confused.
And there's already a better word processing software out there called Pages.
They're living day by day. They don't know what they're doing in this world.
Exactly. Yeah. They probably found it in a garbage can outside a Mac store.
Yep.
So like I said, so this is what I'm talking about. Tongue in cheek. To a certain degree. Because I don't think any of us, you know, obviously we don't believe this about the people, but there's marketing that's being pushed that basically says, if you see a person like this and you see a person like this, these are the things that obviously are true about this person, and these are not. So like they're spitting this narrative and it's working.
Yeah.
It's working well. Because of, I meant to look up the market share that Apple has now, but I didn't. Joe, Tectonic, you know what Apple's market share is right now?
Well, it varies. It depends on what platform you're talking about. The mobile platform is much smaller than a lot of people may realize. And you know, Apple owns the majority of the most profitable sector of the market. So theirs are the most lucrative shoppers there are in the world. If you're buying an Apple, if you're getting an iPhone, you're just the most valuable customers there are in the world. And that's true, even though they're in the minority. You know, the majority of people still buy real crummy, dumb cellular, phones.
They're not smartphones, they're dumb phones.
Right, yeah, the gross majority of people are not using smartphones. But of the smartphone base, the majority of those are Android users or, whatever kind of knockoffs, a mixture of Blackberries are still out there, believe it or not.
That's not true.
Still limping along.
No one is using a Blackberry.
Nobody's using them, but they do exist. It's crazy. That's like, I talked to some of these developers and they're like, well, I have a Blackberry, I have an Android, I have a year old Android, a new Android, I have an old iPhone and a new iPhone. I'm like, wait a minute, what? You carry all of these in your man purse? And they're like, seriously, yes, I do, because I'm a developer. I have to develop for all the different platforms.
Well,
they're dealing with so much fragmentation on the Android side with all the different operating systems.
So seriously, Apple continues to make great strides because they have the most loyal customers. They have the most, as they always boast, Tim Cook is always saying these days that they have the number one in customer satisfaction. And that's true. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty wild because there's a lot of people like me. We've been using Apple products since it was so not hip to be using Apple products. I got onto the Apple bandwagon in 93, and I didn't know anything about Steve Jobs until 2003. And I happened across a unofficial, unauthorized biography called Icon. It was spelled funny, like Icon, iMac. And it was about the first two parts of his life leading up to the original iMac and the iPod. And it was respectful, but it was also a little bit sort of like guesswork, because at the time there weren't that many interviews that the author could get that would give great details about what was happening in Steve's life. But so that got me hooked, though, and I missed the first generation, the first wave of iPods, because they were just way too expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then by the iPod Photo, I think I had one. I got an iPod Nano, and then eventually I got the iPod Video, which was stolen on my wedding day.
Oh, no.
And then I waited around for the iPhones to drop a little bit in price, and then my first iPhone was the fourth, but I always had a Mac. I've always had a Mac, and I've always had an iPad since the first generation, and I've just loved them. So yeah, but I followed Steve's life since 2003.
That's interesting. My first foray into the Big Mac world then was the iPod Color. That was the first one my fiance, my wife now, at the time we bought one together because they're expensive.
Because you were trying to buy something really expensive together. You didn't want to buy a dog.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, but we both own this. We kind of have to stay together now.
Music, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we had the iPod, and then I couldn't get the initial iPhone. I wanted one, but I was on Verizon. You know, for the first couple of years, they weren't on Verizon. That's right. And so I remember we went on our honeymoon, and we tracked down an Apple store out in L.A., and I remember like walking in to see the original iPhone in 2007, just being like blown away. It's like, it has the weather on it. And like, I still have a picture. I can go back and find it.
My expectations are so low right now.
I know, exactly. It's 2007, man.
It doesn't have copy and paste, but it has the weather.
Yeah, it's got the weather. And then I adopted the first iPad. Actually, I got the second iPad, and then because I wanted to wait for the upgrades and stuff. Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting how they pull you in. I think, obviously, for Apple, one of the big things was the iPod. Of kind of, I think, reintroducing themselves to a really broad market at a popular level.
Well, yeah, definitely. Because I remember using iMacs at the schools I went to in college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, it's a different one. It's a little bit different to use.
Yeah.
It kind of looks cool. But like, no one was like, oh, I'm going to buy one of these.
Yeah.
You know, so, but so oddly enough, as cool as the products are, as I guess infamous. Probably better way to say it, as Steve Jobs is now. I wasn't personally super interested in seeing this movie because it was about Steve Jobs. For example, I mean, like, there was a movie last year that had Ashton, was it last year, 2 years ago?
2 years ago now.
You know, Ashton Kutcher was playing Jobs in Jobs. And I was like, oh, I'll see that if I can. But the thing that really got me about this was who was attached to it.
Oh yeah.
And so I would have seen any movie with this impressive, you know, if Danny Boyle combines with Aaron Sorkin, one of my favorite writers, lots of people will probably recognize him from many of the seasons of The West Wing. One of my favorite shows, The Newsroom. He wrote The Social Network, which is incredibly popular. So, you know, he's got some very big things under his belt. Danny Boyle's very, impressive, and he's done some pretty big things as a director. And then, like I said, my general rules, at least right now, I will watch anything with Michael Fassbender in it. At least give it a shot. Because I think he's fairly discerning about the pictures he takes and or the scripts he chooses to do, and that he typically does a pretty good job. So once you start tacking on things like Kate Winslet and Seth Rogen and Jeff Daniels, I'm just like, okay, well, it's just icing on the cake now. So the fact that it happened to also big arm movements, Jason can see my big arm movements, that happened to also be about Steve Jobs was, you know, just another cherry on top of the sundae. I was bought in from the beginning.
Yeah, it does have an interesting group of people attached to the film. I'm a huge Michael Fassbender fan now. Actually, the first performance of his that struck me was that one about old literature. I'm skipping my mind now. But it wasn't his performance in X-Men. It was something more obscure, a romance, a drama. And
his,
I was like,
very
he's pretty
role
good.
In,
yeah.
His very small role in Saving Private Ryan.
No,
not Saving Private Ryan. Band of Brothers.
He got his start. Well, one of his big starts for Fassbender was working with Steve McQueen, who did...
They did Shame.
Shame. But before that, his first big break with McQueen, I think it was McQueen's first film.
Wow.
It was about the Irish hunger strike during the 80s over the Falklands.
Wow,
and,
he gets way back.
Michael Fassbender plays the IRA leader who goes on a hunger strike, and really well done movie. I think it's called Hunger.
Well, if Steve McQueen did it, it's probably pretty intense and well done. That's the problem with Steve McQueen to me as a director. Like, I can appreciate him as a director, but especially for the audience that this will probably the real world theology typically pulls in. After seeing some of his films, I either feel dirty or I can't recommend. Incredible craftsmanship that I don't think people need to see.
I will say I never saw Shame.
You probably shouldn't.
No, I did see Hunger. I saw 12 Years a Slave. And yeah, I'd heard a lot of things about Shame, but it seems like Fassbender and McQueen kind of work together.
So
when he was attached, which is interesting because this whole conversation, in some ways, this was not Sony's first choice. Beyond the writer, they had other David Fincher was attached originally,
which would make sense because it's a social network.
Yeah, because it's a social network, and then Christian Bale was initially tapped But then Fincher and Bale both walked when Sony failed to give final edits to Fincher. And so they're kind of scrambling. So I think this movie's had an interesting life of its own. Not that we will never know what a movie would have been like with Fincher.
I think it would have looked like The Social Network.
Yeah, the script would have been the same. The bones, the heart of the movie, I think would have stayed the same. But I thought they all did a fantastic job playing the roles that they were trying to play. And I think Sorkin came out and said this anyways, but this is not a photograph. Mm-hmm. This is more of like a painter's portrait of Steve Jobs. So they weren't going for even resembling Jobs for that look. They have a few moments in the movie where he does. But he said that wasn't our primary concern, was to have people actually look like.
Yeah, okay, so that hits on one of the first things that I'm curious as to where you guys were. Because from Boyle to Sorkin, like, there is that acknowledgement that this view of Steve Jobs that they're painting in this film, it is a painting rather than a photograph.
Yeah.
They know it's going to be, like, embellished. They know they're going to mess with some of the facts. So I know both you guys are big Apple guys.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, we've already covered that. So where do you land on Steve Jobs, the man and the business
versus the fictional representation?
Yeah, and how does that compare to what you saw in this film? Because, like, I want to know what your general impressions of Jobs was or is, and then separate from that, kind of how this film struck you because of that portrayal and how it matched. And so what we do, Jason, I know you're new, but Joe's on Skype, so Joe gets to go first.
Sure,
go first. So he gets to take all the good answers.
Yeah. Skype rules.
I'll just start thinking whatever the opposite of what you say.
Well, I'd have to say I've been thinking about this a lot because I watched the Jobs pick with Ashton Kutcher, and long before that we had the Pirates of Silicon Valley version, and that told a certain chapter or a certain version of sort of the rival of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and their rivalry, and it went into fictional territory as well. What's interesting about these three movies is that how did people respond to them that knew Steve Jobs, and how did Jobs respond to the first one, because it was a film during his life, and it definitely was something that came across his desk. With Pirates of Silicon Valley, it was one of those novelties where there just weren't all that many films, you know, fictionalizing the story of what was unfolding.
Yeah.
And think about Pirates of Silicon Valley as sort of the original Social Network film. Like, it was trying to convey essentially the same kind of story. And it was a good film, and it was interesting. I think the actor's name was Noah, and he did a good job of portraying Steve in many ways. And what's interesting is that Steve Jobs actually liked the guy's performance so much that he had him portray himself at the beginning of a Macworld event around the same time that the film was coming out. You know, so Steve saw the film at Apple headquarters, and everybody was on the edge of their seats kind of wondering, like, how is Steve going to respond to this film? It kind of paints a dramatic picture, and they took a lot of creative license, and some of it was true. But, you know, the general consensus at Apple was they would rather it be true to life and be more of a documentary than fudge on a lot of details for dramatic license. And Steve actually liked it. He was kind of like, this is fun. Like, guys, we're doing something that's so weird and incredible here that people want to create the make-believe version of it. They want to tell the story their own way with their own spin. Like, we all like Johnny Appleseed, right? Like, we know he was a historical character, but who doesn't want to embellish the story of Johnny Appleseed and turn him into a legend? And, you know, Apple has even used references to Johnny Appleseed in a lot of their little cookies, you know, and presentations and stuff. You'll see a make-believe contacts card for a man named Johnny Appleseed for no apparent reason. It's just there.
Well, so Joe, like, do you mainly reference that because it influenced how you saw Steve Jobs?
It does. It does influence.
So, like, yeah. So what was your
I can appreciate the man and the myth, if that makes sense. So, thankfully, because I had already gotten my feet wet with Pirates of Silicon Valley many years ago, I grew accustomed to the fact that there's going to be creative license taken with the true stories. Like, they're going to try and be true to the spirit of these people's lives without being factually accurate. So if you can say that they captured the spirit of what happened rather than the historical account, and you can be okay with that, then yeah. That's fine. Then they jump forward in time to Ashton Kutcher's portrayal. What was interesting was that that film was trying really hard to be more historically accurate. They couldn't mm-hmm. show it all, but and they knew it was going to be somewhat abridged and cover many years of his life from college and, you know, drugs to actually like making products and being a success and showing what a jerk he could be and, you know, also show the growth of Apple to a point. And
it was more of a classic biopic.
It was. And it also felt like it was an origin story. Where it ended, I felt like, man, where's the sequel? I want to see, you know, Jobs 2, where Ashton Kutcher now picks up things with the iMac and iPod. Bugaloo.
Yeah.
But they didn't go in that direction. And, and actually really annoyed a lot of people in the tech industry and writers because they felt like that film tried so hard to be believable and taken, you know, seriously that when it wasn't something that they could believe in because it got things inaccurate or it just felt like it was so close to life, but it was so artificial at the same time to see Ashton Kutcher imitate Steve Jobs' walk that to think that he, you know, Ashton Kutcher could be anything like the Steve Jobs that was real, just
it was a tall ass.
It was tough. I actually enjoy the film somewhat. I get really psyched when I see the movie because it makes me feel jazzed about, you know, this stuff that I've always enjoyed and appreciated.
Wait,
and I never got to meet
Steve. Or
so.
Jobs?
About the Jobs film, I enjoyed Ashton Kutcher's portrayal. And I enjoyed the film as a whole, even though I know it's not altogether accurate. I thought it was interesting that they tried to be super accurate. And then you get to this one, and Jason, I guess you can concur with this, that this film doesn't really try to be accurate in much of any ways at all. Aaron Sorkin pointed out that when he started making this film, it was the first time in his life he was paying attention to the tech industry and Steve Jobs. He didn't know anything about him. Oh, no. He had never followed him. He didn't give a whit about technology and computers. Mm-hmm. It was only when they got the rights to make a film adaptation of Walter Isaacson's official biography of Jobs that then they started doing some research to turn this into a movie. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you brought up earlier that this Aaron Sorkin was responsible for a lot of the writing and such for West Wing. Mm-hmm. And that was actually, it's interesting to me, this is just an anecdote, but Steve Jobs loved that show.
Oh, yeah.
So in many ways, it's interesting that if there was anybody who was going to make this movie and get Steve Jobs' approval, Steve would have probably given Aaron Sorkin permission to make this film. There's anyone's guess if he would actually like it.
Yeah,
because,
might not have liked it, but...
Yeah, because pretty much everybody else in his life, still alive today, who have seen this film said they were sorely disappointed with the accuracy of this film because basically none of the events in this film are true to life.
Yeah.
It inspired by true events, but not accurate.
Yeah.
And that's where I stand. I feel like entertaining film, but you called it Steve Jobs. And I don't know if y'all would feel the same way, but Citizen Kane was based on a real man's life. But they didn't want it to be considered a biopic, and so they took a lot of creative license, and they didn't use the original man's name. They made up the name Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like that's what this movie should have been. Yeah. This movie shouldn't have been Steve Jobs. It should have been about another archetypal character of some entrepreneur in the Silicon Valley.
I don't think you can do that the amount of information at everyone's fingertips. Mm-hmm. It would be like, oh, obviously they didn't get the rights to this movie. I think everybody would be like, oh, he's playing the Steve Jobs character. Yeah. And I don't think people would like it. I think they would rather have an embellished version.
I agree. I agree. But at the same time, it annoys me. For my sake, that's the movie I would have wanted. But
yeah. So Jason, what was your personal opinion of Steve Jobs? And then how did this movie reflect that?
Yeah, I think I largely concur with Joe. I think, so I did as well, saw Pirates of Silicon Valley, which I believe was actually a TNT miniseries special.
I think it was maybe a two-night special, quote, or something.
Like in theaters, but it kind of got a little cult following of its own.
I remember
watching that right after I got my Mac and kind of like, you know, being introduced to the creator behind the product. And maybe that's in the bugs... the job bug bit. Mm-hmm. And so I watched that film. I did not watch Jobs, not because I didn't want to see it, but just not a big fan of Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah.
Big fan of film, big fan of acting. Didn't think those things would happen in that movie.
You can see why that would actually repel you.
We're against that. Yeah. But maybe I'll have to go back and watch it. But I've also read the Isaacson biography and the most recent one, Becoming Steve Jobs. And I guess the character I was introduced to, obviously I've never met Steve Jobs, would have loved to.
Obviously.
Yeah. Clearly we don't go way back. But the person I met, I think, was just that the charismatic individual that I think that drew a lot of people to him.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about him as a person that just electrified people, for better or worse.
Yeah.
Pensions aside, he had the ability to spark belief and get people to do extraordinary things and really turn the world on its axis in some ways.
Yeah.
And we can parse through how he got to those places.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I knew about the bad stuff. And even when Isaacson's biography came out, there was a lot of pushback from, let's say, tech insiders, people at Apple who knew Steve Jobs, that felt that it wasn't very fair to him. Although this is the one person that Steve Jobs finally let actually write a biography,
mm-hmm.
Which I think, if I remember right, it was pretty late. It's only after he realized he was going to pass away that he finally let someone come in and
I think so
kind of do these things. He had been approached before.
But it didn't come out.
It came out after he passed away.
After he passed away. So mm-hmm. he never actually got a chance to read
no,
it.
No, he never got a chance to read it. Mm-hmm. And I know his wife was very upset with it.
Yeah.
And others have even questioned Isaacson's portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's the basis for the movie, I think we can see why some people landed where they did with it. That being said, I think clearly Jobs's poor decisions that he's made in his life have been well documented. And I feel like this movie just leaned into that. And I feel like it lends some people who don't take the time to realize the other things he was involved with. It just feeds into that narrative about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you don't get that both sides. Because I think if we relate it back to us, I mean, we have all made poor decisions.
Yeah.
And we never want to be reduced to the, you know, the epitome of our bad decisions. We want to say, yeah, you know, I made that big mistake, but I also did this, you know. And I feel like that's what we're missing in this film is it focused in on some key aspects of his personality that were very hard to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Even a really shameful decision to deny paternity to his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But not realizing that they did reconcile. They did, like, he owned up to that and said he shouldn't have done that.
And she lived in his household for many years. He was married. He had other children with his wife, and none of that came up in the movie, but that had happened during the time frame of the movie. Mm-hmm. And they made him out to look like he was still just this flat out jerk, that he was running his life solo. He was a bachelor for life and miserable jerk. And so much had changed by the time that you get to the unveiling of the iMac presentation, which constitutes maybe a third of the film. Mm-hmm. He was running Pixar, and he was running Pixar in large part because of his own standard, his own version of family values. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was interested in Pixar.
Yeah. I think I read the article by, I think, Walt Mossberg from, I believe that's his last name, from CNET, who interviewed Jobs multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've heard people say about the Isaacson biography and Walt Mossberg said is that much of those things that we associate with Jobs that were very negative were very much true in his early years. And what a lot of people have spoken out against is that as Jobs grew and matured, like we all do,
mm-hmm.
those things kind of got evened out a little bit. And it was tough to see a movie portray, like, this is the definitive work. It's Steve Jobs, the movie.
On that note, if you think about his life and you break it down into decades,
mm-hmm.
it's like his life didn't really begin until after college. Like, he went through his teenage, you know, rebellion in his 20s. If mm-hmm. you just think about what was actually going on, he was doing drugs and he was a college dropout. Mm-hmm. And then he started doing crack business and stuff with Steve Wozniak mm-hmm. getting into his 20s. But it was like his 20s were his rebellious teen mm-hmm. decade.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. then hitting his 30s was when he was mm-hmm. hitting what most people get in their 20s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when I think about Jobs, when I think about Steve Jobs, most of my only context mm-hmm. is seeing like one keynote.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you know, late Apple adopter.
Yeah.
And mostly just hearing what people have said about him,
mm-hmm.
the kind of person that he came off, you know, like the misunderstood genius, misunderstood artist kind of person. And I really like the observation that Wade Bearden made in his Christ in Pop Culture review of Steve Jobs, when he said he may not look like the man, because they made a big deal about how he didn't ever really have to look like, or in fact, Michael Fassbender never had to look like Steve Jobs, but he feels like the man. And as I would assume that most people who like Apple products and know who Steve Jobs is or was, I think I'm the everyman in this situation. We just heard stories. We've heard rumors. And I think that in this particular case, I think Sorkin probably paints a picture that matches what most people assume is who Steve Jobs was.
The
good part about that,
in a way to put it, is that you're familiar with the icon of the man, and this was a representation of the icon.
Okay. So the icon, that iconic figure that he has become, the person who saved Apple, the person who has given us all the gadgets that we love. I don't know why I'm doing big hands today. I don't usually do big hands. I think it's because Jason's just looking at me. He's sitting right across the table. I'm doing big arms. Anyone, no one can see big arms. They would have never known.
This is my first podcast, but we don't get arm motions.
It's all video. It's for the
theater app. For the mind.
So like they're used to this iconic person, this iconic figurehead. And to me, though I would agree, not knowing the depth at which Jason, you or Joe obviously have you know, paid attention to Steve Jobs' life. To me, it looked like they took this icon, and by the end of the film, they made him a man.
I think that they kind of did.
Yeah, there's a little redemption towards the end.
And so it's not even like there's, but that's the thing. I didn't need full redemption. No. I just needed to know that he could grow to be, like, he needed to, he was a human.
Yeah, they gave him an arc.
Yeah, so he became, like, Steve Jobs, in my mind now, because of this film, is less icon and more human, who had flaws, but was always trying to either better himself and had reasons for the things that he did. He wasn't just like this person who did things. Did amazing things. Also some bad things, lots of bad things, but you know, it was always growing. And that growth, that connection that you can feel through watching the story, to me, was great. Like I said, I think most of the complaints I've heard, most of the people who I've seen give the movie not so favorable reviews, are people who know a lot about Steve Jobs.
People who know too much about the history,
Or people who have a connection to Apple, or people who want a biopic to be a traditional biopic, which almost no one ever likes.
Like J. Edgar, for example.
Like the BBC made the Life of Steve Jobs bio series.
There's so few bio, like everyone wants biopics on their favorite people, but almost every time a biopic comes out, even a great biopic is like, that's like 3 or 5 stars. It was okay. I mean, like,
it's interesting because I think there's that level where life is less interesting than we think it is. I mean, so when we get a straight up biopic, we're like, really, I want some more, you know, excitement. And maybe that's what Sorkin delivered. I will say, as Steve Jobs stands as a movie, take that name off of it, I think the movie was great. If we put the history aside, the way the film holds together and the way he wrote it, I think is brilliant.
Why it's one of the best movies that I've seen all year, because I'm not bringing a whole lot to it. And I had no Steve Jobs representation ideas that I was bringing to the film. I was just trying to, like, do I enjoy this film? Does it tell me a story? Does it make me relate to this human being? And it did. And now it's actually got me interested to go back and do the research that I haven't done to this point.
Yeah, because that's what I think is interesting when we come back to Jobs' role as a father, let's say, is that from all accounts, from his wife to his kids that he obviously said are my kids, apart from Lisa, they all said that he was a great father. That they felt deeply loved, deeply cherished, valued. And he would go on vacations for weeks at a time, take his kids on these events to help them find out who they were and their identity. And it's just weird, like, I guess, knowing that and saying, okay, yeah, he did deny for 13 years is really bad.
That's kind of bad.
Yeah, it's really bad. We're not saying that, but like, I think like what Walt Mossberg said, we never want the most shameful event of our life to define us. I think that's for where the movie landed, was you picked out a moment clearly shameful. Which is interesting because that's where Sorkin said when he was reading the biography, that's for him where the story began. The movie came out of was this relationship between a father and a daughter. he wasn't as interested in obviously the tech stuff.
Yeah.
But he said for him, the heart of the story was this relationship between a father and a daughter.
Well, and you could see that. Yeah. It was abundantly clear throughout the film that it was about the father and daughter relationship. Mm-hmm. But think about Aaron Sorkin again. He didn't know much about Jobs before preparing this script. So in doing his research, he found this thing. He discovered the thing that you and I knew all along for many years now, and we kind of grown accustomed to the relationship of Steve and Lisa. And for somebody who's just new to all of Steve's life, it is definitely his biggest failure. It's so blatant. Oh, yeah. It's so obvious that it, I mean, like if you started looking into this tomorrow, Fizz, and you started reading the biography, it would probably strike you as well. Like if you were making a movie about his life, you don't see how you could avoid talking about Lisa because it's such an obvious big character flaw. What's interesting though, for people like us is that we've been aware of this character flaw for so long, and it's an old character flaw that was resolved before the year 2000 that we've moved far past it. And we kind of feel like the movie neglected so many other interesting things that our disappointment isn't so much that they dealt with Lisa, is so much that they left out so many other things.
So I like this mental picture that I'm getting of Joe sitting in the theater and like Lisa pops on screen. He's like, heard it.
Yes. Yes.
Move on.
I think I'm with Joe on that point you made about the Kutcher Jobs, is that like I'm fine with the movie, but like what Joe said earlier, I kind of want part two now. Like, okay, you showed us part one, the early life. Show us where he went. Show us how he grew. You know?
And I'm fine with that. I would take it. I'm a big Aaron Sorkin fan.
He's a busy guy, though, these days.
He's a busy guy, and if he wants to write part two,
I'd be happy with just the movie about Steve Jobs and Pixar, even if you wanted to leave out everything else during that decade and just talk about the backstory of Pixar with him in meetings with John Lasseter and the like. Like, that would be cool.
Well, and so that's interesting, too, because I think that as popular as Pixar is now, you know, people didn't really know that Pixar was Pixar, except for people who were like really into film.
Yeah.
Or really into Steve Jobs or something like that. They didn't realize Pixar was Pixar. They just thought, oh wow, a lot of good animated movies have been coming out recently.
Yeah.
And I, like, you know, I was mentioning that on the way out of the theater that Steve Jobs, I was like, oh, it's like when Steve Jobs was involved in making Pixar happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, my wife was like, what?
Yeah.
And I was like, I mean, you know, because like I said, most people didn't know who. I'm not even sure as to the extent. That Jobs was involved. I just know that he was highly involved.
Oh yeah,
and you know, it was like kind of his thing. And
some have said he single-handedly saved Pixar.
He's saving everything. Complex. Yeah. Or you could say, like I think this movie does, he has a control complex.
Yeah, he does.
And see, that's the thing. I love the honesty with which this film talks about control, because like control can be obvious. But I think lots of the time, control is deceptive because we don't realize we're trying to take control. And I love the fact that they have this conversation that's very like, why, you know, what's it about? And he says, hey, I'm very self-aware. It's about control. Mm-hmm. But because it reminds me that like, so I have a coworker who's honestly one of the nicest and, you know, most selfless guys that I've met. But like he'd bring in coffee for the office. He'd offer to grab like food for you if he, you know, went out to lunch and all, you know, all these nice things. And, you know, one time I was like, oh, I'm going to do something nice for him. Mm-hmm. And so I went out to get lunch. I bought him something back and he was like, oh, how much do I owe you? And I was like, you don't owe me anything, man. You know, I was like, you're always doing nice things for me. I'm finally glad I'm able to do something for you. That's how a friendship works. And he was like, no. He tried to offer me money. I said, no, offer me money. He said, no. And finally, I just walked away, you know, like, I don't want your money. And later, I came in the next day and I found the money, like, sitting on my keyboard.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, oh, like, why does this hit me? Like, why am I upset about this?
Yeah.
You know, like, because it seems like a good thing that someone would want to pay for their stuff, like, you know. But I thought about it and I ended up getting this conversation with him. And it was a conversation about control. I was like, hey, man, I know you're doing nice things for me. I mean, like extremely nice things for me. Mm-hmm. But like if you only do for others and you refuse to let people do for you, you are in control of that relationship. Like all the control, all the kindness, it's all on your terms. Like, you're never opening yourself up. Yeah. And so, like, if you never open yourself up for anyone doing nice things to you, like, you never lose control of who has the power in the relationship. You never owe anybody anything. You never feel indebted to anybody.
Yeah.
You never have to worry about thanking people. Like, you're in control of the relationship. And he was like, oh, I never thought about it that way. He was like, I think we're friends. I'm like, well, if we're friends, then, like...
It's a two-way street.
I was like, why is it okay for you to do things for me and me not do things for you? I mean, I was like, we're still not even close to even.
Yeah.
Like, you're still winning. You're like, still by a lot. You know? I was like, but I can't bring you some cinnamon rolls or something.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's the subversive ways that control works. And I don't think we see this in any better way than when Jobs and Wozniak are having this conversation. When Wozniak in the film comes to, like, you know, he's like, hey, I'm clearing the air.
Yeah.
I just want to start, you know, kind of start, start over. And then without apologizing, Jobs says, don't worry, you always get a pass with me. Mm-hmm. And Wozniak, like, flips out, you know, and he says some choice words. Yeah. I mean, and it just really set Wozniak off. So my question is, like, should it have? Mm-hmm. Like, Joe, should it have made Wozniak flip out that much to get this pass from Jobs?
Well, what we see with the portrayal of Steve Wozniak is a guy who's really frustrated with really old problems that never got resolved. And I think what they're doing is they're bringing out his nerdy tendencies, his engineering tendencies. They're showing this guy who is very, sort of like logical. He cannot understand Steve Jobs. So his logical mind is broken when it comes to all things Steve. Like, and there's that stuff you hear in the trailer a lot. Like, what do you do? I built the computer. The graphic interface was stolen. What do you do? And he can't understand Jobs. And so, and when Steve says something he doesn't even comprehend, it just really gets him. It really gets to him. And, you know, you feel like Wozniak is like this guy who is stuck in the past. They reinforce that over and over again, that Wozniak in the movie is a character who is stuck in the past. When you didn't do it right, you must go back and make it right. And Jobs is this kind of guy who's kind of like, I don't care if I did it right or wrong. I'm going to keep going ahead because all that life is about is change. And so I'm constantly about change. And if you can't change along with me, Wozniak, then you're just a relic of my history. You're a relic of my past, you know?
Okay, so Joe, I want to push back just a little bit, because the way at least you're describing it from where I'm sitting.
I'm looking at it in terms of review. I'm not saying that this is good or bad. I'm just saying this is how they characterize it.
So that's what I'm asking. Like, I'm saying, like, if you're Wozniak, and okay, you know, to me, this is like, I mean, they're close friends.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, they're opposites attracting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine if I ever got in a fight with my wife, and I was obviously the one who was wrong,
mm-hmm.
and she's like, I just want to make things right, and I'm like, hey, don't worry about it, babe. You always get a pass. I don't feel like that's going to go over very well. Not only do I not think it's going to go over very well, but I mean, I feel that she probably has every right to flip out.
Yes.
And so I don't think me saying something like, look, I'm always looking forward. We're always going to be a couple, you know, let's not dwell in the past. Like, there are things that you have to work out. You know, like, there are some things metaphorically in this film, like, you know, at some point the Apple II needed to die.
Mm-hmm.
It needed to, something, a new product needed to come along, because we saw trying to resurrect Apple II was eventually going to nearly bankrupt Apple.
Yeah.
So there is some of that. But at what point do we balance saying, look, it's in the past, it doesn't matter? Because this is like the, oh, just forgive and forget, or just forget it, it's in the past. Mm-hmm. Like, where is that balance?
Yeah, I think part of that aspect, and Joe is right, this clearly in the movie, Wozniak is the past and Jobs is going forward. Mm-hmm. But I think the more you get to know Steve Jobs through books or people say about him, is that he was so future-oriented, looking towards the next thing, being an innovator, finding out what we need before we need it, that I can see that being somewhat true to life for him, of saying, why are we talking about that? Like, I'm on to the next thing already.
But I think I know why.
The mental energy to go back there.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, the real Steve Jobs was a guy who had some goals, long-term goals. Like, he didn't really care ultimately about the Macintosh, even though it was a tremendous milestone. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful machine, and he sang its praises from day one, and he wanted it mm-hmm. to say hello to the audience when it was unveiled. But mm-hmm. really, if you go back into the depths of the 80s and you look at what Steve was attempting, he wanted something that was like Siri. He wanted something that was like the iPad. He mm-hmm. thought that the personal computer should be an artificially intelligent book. And he mm-hmm. wanted music to be just like everywhere around you in life, that it was inescapable. Like he wanted to just, you know, on a whim, walk into his home and think the thought, I would like to hear such and such a music, and it would just cue. Mm. So these were things early in Steve's life where he thought, okay, maybe computers are the way to get there. And he wasn't thinking about personal computers. He wasn't thinking about DOS. He wasn't thinking about Steve Wozniak. He was thinking about the long game. It wasn't about IMAX. It wasn't about Next. It was about where can we get these things to be in 25 years from now? And so I think that he was producing things that a lot of people would think in the 80s, this is like your legacy, Steve. Mm-hmm. You've done some amazing things. You're creating a legacy here. And he was saying, legacy? No, this is not going to be my legacy. I'm thinking about something that is far off in the distance, and I want that to be so great it'll outweigh anything I'm doing here in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's that famous story about in Isaacson's biography that I learned when I read it, that essentially Jobs invented the iPad first and then set it aside to create the iPhone.
Oh, you think that's cool?
Yeah,
get this. Okay, there's
well, even know, Jeff.
Oh, yeah, this is great. You got to look this up. I'm not sure where it is. Mm-hmm. I listened to it a while ago. But there was some people that made some kind of like cassette tape of Steve talking at a press event or something back in the mid-80s. It was around 84. So it was while he was still at Apple. And it was, I don't remember the context, but for about 20 minutes, Steve described the iPad. And the reason that he was talking about it was because it was like the one of the products that he wanted to build next. They just didn't know how to do it. And so this was him casting the vision. But remember, I'm talking about the mid-80s here. He is describing the iPad as if he's holding it in his hand. And if you didn't know better, he was giving it in a presentation on stage. Yeah. But this was the mid-80s.
Maybe he's just watching a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation.
That could be true. I think this goes back to what makes Apple. I mean, it's this sense of what we've done is not good enough. Not that it's not good enough, but that was then, but we're moving on to the next thing. And that's why Apple has continued to innovate, where you've seen companies like Dell, for example, HP, Acer, at one time on the top of the market, but they stayed there. They were okay with that. And what seems to make Jobs so different is that the mind-blowingly creative things that he does are just one in a long line of things that he's going to do. Yeah, I think that goes back to that Wozniak Jobs character. Wozniak is, I think, more that mindset of, well, we've done a great thing. Is that what we're here to do? Mm-hmm. And Jobs is always like, okay, what's the next thing? And that's what set Apple apart.
In the movie, this was demonstrated when he's dealing with Lisa in the late part of the film, and they create this scenario where he has the inspiration for the iPod. And it was actually a very poignant moment. It was kind of clever. I really enjoyed it. But I also knew that it was completely fictionalized. Yeah. Nothing about that scenario happened. But it was pretty clever for the emotion of the moment. It was true about Steve Jobs, the man, even though it was not factually accurate, that he's observing the Walkman that his daughter is using. And he says to himself and to her, I'm going to build you a far better player. It'll hold like hundreds of songs. Maybe 1,000 songs.
And okay, so we're between 500 and 1,000. I love that line. Yeah. That's so good.
But yeah, that invoked exactly what you're describing.
Yeah. So what I would ask, because we keep coming back to Steve Jobs as the visionary, we keep coming back to like the thing that set him apart, the thing that, to a certain degree, I don't know if you guys hear, but you're arguing that it's okay.
That, I knew this question was coming.
Yeah, that Steve Jobs was a jerk of his vision. Yeah. But how do you... Okay, so Apple was innovative. Mm-hmm. Apple was always pushing the envelope. Now Steve Jobs is not there anymore. Do you still see Apple doing this, or do you see Apple basically cashing in on making the things that they have made better?
Well, I mean, this is the question I've always wrestled with Jobs when I was reading the biography. It's the classic, does the ends justify the means? Mm-hmm. I mean, classic question of our lives. And I think, you know, with Jobs, this gets put front and center. Clearly, he's made world-changing products. Mm-hmm. We always had that, okay, how do you get there? How do you treat people on the way to getting towards success? And I think that that's the ethical question that gets, I think, raised, at least from my point of view, is... And I think this is encapsulated in that last scene between Wozniak and Jobs. We're saying, you know, you can be gifted and decent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the part I think we're always trying to hit is clearly Jobs was gifted. He wasn't at all times decent.
Yeah.
And so I think that for me is that ethical rub of can we have what we have and also be good human beings at the same time? You know, I don't think those have to be mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think in some sense, many people say, okay, Jobs was a visionary. We're going to give him a pass, to use his own words, on all these bad things that he's done.
Yeah.
You get a pass, Steve, because you created the iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that's a question to wrestle with. Like, should you get a pass for treating people horribly or maybe pushing them too hard? Where does that line come in, treating people like human beings and not just means to an end?
Yeah. So the justification for mm-hmm. that still comes from the mm-hmm. fact that people hold him up to this certain standard,
mm-hmm.
hold him up to this icon that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not just a human. He's this larger yeah. than life thing.
Yeah.
So do you think that, well, I guess I ask you a second, okay. Other part question more yes. directly first. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Apple is still innovating?
Personally, I do. I don't think they're innovating in the same ways, but I think they have that in their DNA.
Okay.
I think,
do you think that different direction more backs up Steve is the ultimate visionary narrative?
I do. I think he and other people who have studied like business schools, mm-hmm. Steve actually went a long way out of his way to try to teach who he was mm-hmm. to Apple, almost preparing for his life after Apple, knowing that he was obviously going to die someday. They brought in people to do case studies on how he made decisions
mm-hmm.
and trying to bake that into the DNA of Apple. And I think Tim Cook has done a good job. At that,
there's a little hesitation in your
eyes. Yeah, I mean, he's not Steve Jobs. He doesn't have the charisma or the persona.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're faithfully carrying on. For me, from my point of view, faithfully carrying on that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I would be interested to see what things Jobs would come back and say, I can't believe you're doing that. I think, on my end, I think the lines are getting too like they were before he came back to Mac and mm-hmm. had to simplify.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I could see that being a problem in Apple's future. Of too many products, too many lines. Now we got the 11-inch MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook, the 13-inch MacBook, and I could see Jobs coming in going, guys, we need one. Like, you know, go back to the basics.
Yeah, so, in 2020, we'll get cars. So.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Whoa, too much of a product line.
So, it reminds me of one of the most tweetified,
mm-hmm.
tweetered thing that I saw during the last Apple...
Mm-hmm.
Apple thing?
The keynote?
Sure, we'll call it a keynote. We'll call it the self-gratification expo.
Yeah, I watch those religiously, so just be careful.
Yeah. Well, I do now too. So, like the last one I saw, I remember like one of the most tweeted things that was the Steve Jobs quote where it's like, mm-hmm. if you're holding a pen, you've already failed or whatever.
Yep.
And I love the fact that in the movie he says, well, the best...
Yes.
It was a stylist. The best stylist is you can't use all the other five.
The other five.
You know, and so when I see things like that, so Joe, I would use that to ask mm-hmm. you the same question I'm asking Jason. Like, do you see Apple as like it's not halting because they're mm-hmm. still creating new things, but do you think like the vision has significantly changed or changed in any discernible way since Jobs has left? Since, again, we're holding Jobs up as the innovator.
Mm-hmm.
So he's either passed that on or we should notice a discernible difference.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it depends on, you know, Steve actually surrounded himself with people that were capable of innovation, and they were a crack team that over the years did it time and again. For instance, Steve didn't come up with many key factors about the iPod. He just knew he wanted a music player, and he wanted to blow away the Walkman, which was still dominant at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was actually...
Or the Discman.
The Discman was essentially the Walkman, but yeah, it was screwed. It was messed up. It was always doomed. But yeah, the Steve had a great team that were innovators at the time, and a lot of those people are still, you know, very key roles throughout Apple's huge business. The thing was is that Steve, as a leader, was concerned about design. So he was often, you know, sizing up design, and he'd like to share designs with people and friends to see how they interacted with a design. And then based on like a lot of his intuition, he would go back to the drawing board and he'd go to the teams and say, I know we got to get this product out the door in a few months, but we are going to re-engineer X, Y, and Z because this is not good enough. We're going to make it better. We're going to make it more perfect. We're going to make it, you know, we're going to make the product that everybody doesn't know they want yet. But the thing is, there's not really that kind of person now in Apple. There's Johnny Ive, who is a brilliant designer, surrounding himself with more brilliant designers. He's still adding to the team. But you don't have executives outside of the designer team that are also concerned with design. So Tim Cook is an operations guy. Tim Cook is thinking about, you know, that sort of angle and concerned with those matters. And he is saying, you, Johnny Ive, the head of all design here, can be fully responsible for design issues. I want no part of it. You can have carte blanche. And that's not what Steve did. Steve wanted to be Tim Cook and Johnny Ive. So he was the guy responsible for leading the company, but also when he could, he was telling the designers what to do. So there was an era not too long ago where everything was looking like tangible materials in the operating systems. So the calendar looked like it was made with leather and paper. And iOS 6 and every version of iOS before 6 looked like it was made with tangible plasticky materials, leathers, and you know, other like physical objects. And all of that was Steve's demand. Steve wanted things in the software to look like they were physical materials.
Like real life.
And that was something he deemed to be innovative and intuitive and more useful and user-friendly. And then everybody post Steve, people who worked with Steve, gave Steve what he wanted. They said, we totally understand Steve wanted those things. We, honest to God, with all of our being, think that those things were wrong decisions and we want to get rid of the faux leather. And so they ditched it. And that is why we have iOS 7 and, you know, the uproar of everything looking like flat paper, you know, flat shapes and stuff, which is more recent design. So I think the innovation is still happening. We're just not getting the same flavor of it.
And I think that's what will be interesting to see going forward, because you have, I mean, I think my faith in the company is with Johnny Ive personally, just because he's pushing the design element. But yeah, the question will be, is there going to be someone who can be forward looking and somehow grasp both sides of those spectrums of design and operations? But that's what's interesting about the movie, though, is we see throughout the movie, technology is almost always trying to keep up with Jobs himself. So they have to use, you know, a faster computer to run the Hello, because the one that they have doesn't work. The Next doesn't have an operating system. keep it going. You know, Jobs is just always two steps ahead of where the technology is. So even going back to what Joe said about, you know, in the 80s talking about the iPad, I think that encapsulates who he was. It's like he saw these things and then moved heaven and earth
to try to get them,
to get these things made. And that that's going to be very hard to replace.
Well, so the last thing that I want to make sure we hit on is there's this theme that runs through the film about adoption and fatherhood that I couldn't really shake. And I think it kind of comes to a head because we've already talked about like there's that last act, and then one of the last scenes in the act where he's kind of almost redeeming himself with Lisa specifically, and how that's kind of a theme that runs through the thing. But I think one of the last and most memorable lines of the film, the one that I see the most in reviews and stuff, is when you know, Fassbender as Jobs says or admits, "I'm poorly made." It humanizes him, and it's the epitome of this struggle that we've seen with control, with trying to find an identity, hoping for Jobs to become, I guess, a human and not just a computer artist computer thing. But in the film, Jobs wants the approval of John Scully, you know, played by Jeff Daniels. His father figure in
which
the
never
film,
happened, by the way, in real life. Yeah, go ahead.
He never wanted the approval of John Scully.
Not during the 90s. I mean, like that ship had sailed, but yeah.
But early on, I think that was he did look up to Scully.
Yeah, it was true. Yeah. About, it was true about their early relationship.
Early relationship.
Yeah, so he's got the relationship obviously fictionalized in the film, but not
a bad one. Still entertaining. Definitely good for the story.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it fits in his whole adoption narrative desiring to have a father, like I would say everyone's created to want. But he wants perfection, something that he can attain, something that will kind of almost make up for this place that he's found himself in life of possibly not being wanted, possibly not really having anyone tell him that he's doing a good job, you know, because like everyone, it's like, see, he's contentious with everybody because everyone just doesn't understand him. But I think the film more than hints at the fact that in his admittance of his imperfection and his reconciliation with his daughter, they come in line thematically with his first successful product launch. So when we finally see him kind of become a human being, and we see him on the teetering on the brink of becoming a good person, or at least a person with a conscience. It's thematically lined up with him being finally succeeding at one of these launches. But even then, he's still kind of looking inward or to another product for his value. And Jason, you've already talked about how he was never really finding his identity in the thing that he had created. He's kind of always finding it in that seeking perfection. So we see Steve Jobs broken. Is that really as hopeful as we can get for Steve in this movie?
I think the character played by Kate Winslet in the movie, Joanna Huffman, kind of has that line, I'm roughly paraphrasing, of, you know, when you're a father, the best thing that you make shouldn't be a product. It's your kid. And I think there is this sense of, yeah, he is looking at these products as a way to, I don't know, find his place in the world, obviously. And, you know, he obviously was adopted. But I find that when I was reading this in another review, that, you know, for a guy whose goal was to make human life easier, which is what all these products are doing, he had a very hard time being a human with other humans. I mean, like, it was very hard to be a human around him. And so there's, like, this tension between what he creates and how he is. I think, you know, going back to the father thing, what's interesting in the Isaacson biography is that one of the stories I remember with Jobs telling about his adopted father is learning some of the lessons he took into his life at Apple about... there's a story about him being at like a wood workshop table and his dad taking care on like the inside of a shelf that no one's going to see. And his dad tells him this lesson basically that, you know, it matters inside and out. And so you see Jobs' perfectionist qualities kind of springing from, well, I saw my dad do this and this is perfection and we're going for this. And that's clearly what puts Apple products on a different level. They are very, very good products. But I think there's that sense of getting caught up in this identity of it's perfection or nothing.
Or nothing.
I think that's where the danger comes in on the health scale of being a healthy individual, of saying, you know, it's a work in process. And perfection may not be what you get at, but, you know, being a good human being, working with people that are around you, being loving to those that you've created, like your daughter, are in some ways more valuable than the products you create, whether that's an iPhone or an iPad.
I asked this question, you know, having some piece of answer to it myself, because it is something that I feel like you could show someone and be like, look, this person who was worth billions of dollars, you know, like, it's like they're so close to understanding like this truth that like, you're not perfect. Like, no one is perfect. And it's not till you recognize that someone or that you're not perfect, that you realize that you need something bigger than yourself.
I think there's this point for me when I was reading through the biography that kind of hit at two different places. And it's about the amount of money. Jobs made a lot of money, obviously. But the thing that kept reverberating in my brain as I read through the biography, just coming from my background, was, you know, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, you can gain the whole world and lose your soul.
Mm-hmm.
And in some levels, Jobs had it all. I mean, visionary creator,
just
more money
soul.
Than he knew what to do with. But in some sense, like, and you see that in the broken relationship with his daughter, like, he lost some things through mm-hmm. the way. And it, I think, really emphasizes this thing of you can have everything that you ever dreamed of,
mm-hmm.
But there is something that's still missing in that realm. Maybe that's that drive of trying to find that thing.
I would agree.
Something, can I note on something too that struck me about the movie in terms of like the messages of the themes of the film?
Yeah,
and related but not the same as what we've already addressed. Is that as it behaves sort of like a play structure, and everything about this movie could be transformed into a three-act play.
Mm-hmm.
You see everything mm-hmm. going on behind the scenes of the stage and then on the stage in interacting with the audience, but mostly interacting with close colleagues and family and friends, that there's sort of an interesting setup that you have Steve interacting with several unique human relationships. So there's Steve as the partner with his best friend, estranged best friend, Steve Wozniak. There is Steve as the boss dealing with Andy Hertzfeld, who is someone who mm-hmm. had a positive relationship with Steve at times and other times didn't. And sometimes it was a problem where Andy maybe crossed the line into Steve's family matters and like did things for Steve that, you know, Steve never gave him a right to do. But then there's also this other relationship with dealing with a professional woman, you know, Joanna Hoffman. Mm-hmm. So you see the Steve dealing with his work wife. Yeah. And then, and then you have the Steve dealing with his estranged girlfriend, you know, Chrisanne Brennan. And then Steve dealing with his young daughter, his teenage daughter, and now his adult, you know, college-age daughter. And then you have Steve dealing with his mentor and then his estranged mentor. Like, you mm-hmm. see what I'm saying? Like, the movie is about Steve dealing with a ton of different, unique, specific relationships that one way or the other we can all relate to somehow. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we're kind of broken people, like you said earlier, Fizz. We can identify, you know, some way in which our brokenness connects with Steve's, even though we're in a completely different plane. And maybe, yes, this is fictional, but this film was about relationships, human relationships in our present day. Like, we can all relate to these human relationships somehow and get that sense of regret. When we're seeing Steve make tons of mistakes, we realize, like, the takeaway from this is we're seeing how broken someone can be before his pride and yet mm-hmm. seem to gain the world but lose it. You know, mm-hmm. he has gained the world, but he has lost everything that mattered. And then there's that the last act of the film where it's about how much of saving the things that matter can he possibly do? And mm-hmm. his pride gets in the way from making a lot of restoration with, like, John Scully and Steve mm-hmm. Wozniak. But thankfully, when it super duper matters, mm-hmm. he can let down a lot of his pride in order to mm-hmm. restore some of his relationship with Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the takeaway for the audience is that, you know, we subconsciously need to get that point that if there's nothing else you can do right, at least get your act together with your kids, get your mm-hmm. act together with your family. And I think that was driven home a little mm-hmm. bit nonsensically, even, you know, the way the film portrayed it mm-hmm. to the end. But still, there was that very definite theme, like which relationships are going to be important and which ones mm-hmm. must you get right if nothing else.
But it sounds like a very culturally acceptable,
yeah.
you know, way, yes. way to kind of
yeah.
end the film,
yeah.
or yes. a theme to the film, which I think would be very, very Apple of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, very, hey, guys, like, be good to people.
Yeah.
I mean, buy our products, but, like, be good.
Be good.
You know, to things.
That exactly.
Mean good things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, that's, so I think that is a well pointed out theme mm-hmm. because I think it, like I said, again, mm-hmm. fits right in with the mantra yeah. that Apple would do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I think Apple products, mm-hmm. I think humanism.
Yeah.
You know, I yes. think be good.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that, I think, is a good theme.
Think different.
Yeah, I think different or differently, depending on how you construct that sentence. yeah, I think that's one of the big things that we hit on. I think that I guess what drew me to Jobs and the movie and all this is that at the heart of it, though, at least from a theological perspective, you see someone who is in the image of God, someone who's a creator at the end of the day. He likes creativity, he likes to create new things. And that, for me, I think was one of the most interesting parts about Jobs, the man, the myth, the legend, is at the end of the day, he is actually tapping into a core part of our identity, that we are actually meant to be creative people. And no one better exemplifies that than a Steve Jobs, of the way he was forward-thinking. And that's the really sad part of the story, is that from all accounts, that was he never really made a move towards a Jesus figure, to Jesus himself. And it's so weird that he emphasizes just that one of the most important aspects of our being human is being creative, helping, I joke, reversing the curse. This is what Apple's doing, making life easier for everybody. But getting so close, but yet being so far away.
So in that element. To end, because I can choose to have the final word. Well, before we all do all the closing stuff, is that what I like about what you just said is I think it also proves this idea that even the best of gifts or the best things that remind us that we're created in the image of the creator is they can still be corrupted.
Oh yeah.
I mean, like they're still like God can redeem them. Hopefully he has redeemed my MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
Because I doth love it so. But
I would love to see some glorified iPods in heaven.
You know, so like, some of that can be redeemed, but that's like, it's like many people who have been blessed with all kinds of gifts, and especially gifts that are reminiscent of the creator that we worship, God like loved obviously creating things. He loved beautiful things.
Yeah.
He made everything. He loved telling stories. It's why people who make movies are great.
Yeah.
But then it's depressing to see like Michael Bay make a movie and like, corrupt this thing that God
Michael
has made.
Michael Bay slam.
Yeah. He's Michael Bay slam. So that's the thing about Jobs for me, oh, you were so gifted. Yeah. I just hate to see. He didn't necessarily waste it. I wouldn't use the word waste, but like, think about what, if fully understanding where that came from and what it could be used for.
And what that points to.
Yeah. I mean, what it points to.
Yeah.
So, well, like I said, we hit real life, we hit book interpretation, we hit this film. All mixed in because there's a lot of stuff that's like said and culturally just penetrating about Steve Jobs. So hopefully you're able to kind of shuffle some of that stuff around. And there's lots more that this movie could hit on. All these individual scenes, all these things that Sorkin kind of threw in there. And this conversation does not necessarily have to stop. But for time's sake, we are going to slow ours down. And we do that by Joe, I'm going to let you tell me what about this movie just kind of made you say, come on, if anything.
Oh, yeah.
So what was it that kind of annoyed you about this movie?
Thank you. I've been waiting for this moment. when I was watching the movie, I had that moment of, this is so the moment I'm going to talk about with this.
Yeah. I love people thinking about me when they watch film. That's my goal.
That's a win.
Yeah. So, guys, it killed me. Backstage during the IMAC event, he's arguing with Lisa, and out of the blue, it seemed like this was horribly staged, because in the other two moments of time when he was backstage with people, he had a lot of privacy, and he was just with his staff, and they were controlling who could see him and who could not. But in this event, backstage, it's like a shopping mall. It's like the coffee bar must be right there. There's posters all over the place of the Think Different campaign. But there's all these young people that are hanging out on their devices and talking to each other. They all look like they're Lisa's like friends from school, but they're not. They're not talking to Steve. They're not talking to Lisa. They're just there. So you're assuming they work for Apple, right? But what are they doing? And Lisa and Steve are having this super private, sensitive issue conversation where they're heated with each other and they're saying some hugely embarrassing things. And there's like 30 people that are witnessing this and it doesn't make any sense. Like, where are the people that give a whit about what Steve is doing right before he goes on stage to introduce a huge product? None of them are around. Like, none of his staff are there. And where is this place in the backstage of the theater. And why are all these people just gawking and listening to Steve rant with his daughter? It was so ridiculous. It felt like a movie moment, Hollywood through and through. It just doesn't belong in reality.
Well, if they weren't there, then you couldn't throw in that line about, does anyone else have any opinions about this?
I just had that line and didn't use it.
He said, well, I gotta have a hallway full of people or I can't use this line.
I know.
There is this thing about Sorkin. I read this, that he has various lines that he works into all of his scripts.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sorkinites, the Sorkin nerds, mm-hmm. wait to listen for those.
Yeah.
I wish I could give you an example, but I'm blanking right now.
Such as whenever wait till we go back around with our favorite moments, and you can quickly. Actually, didn't bring a computer. You didn't bring anything.
Yeah, my iPhone. I'm good.
You can look one up. But before you do that, Jason, tell us what anything you would have changed or you didn't like about this movie.
So one of the kind of scenes I didn't like, and this would go back to probably Danny Boyle's direction, and this is probably just him as a director, maybe I just disagree with the mm-hmm. direction of the film, is at two points in the movie, he flashes up the words to Dylan lyrics, mm-hmm. which is a whole other thing we could talk about.
Yeah.
The role of Dylan in Jobs' life. And then another part, he shows a rocket, like, taking off.
Mm-hmm.
When he's describing it. And I'm one of those things, you can just tell me, and I'm going to get it. You don't need to, like, really punch it in my face. And just from like a movie level, it only happens twice. So it's almost just like this degree of randomness. Like, hey, let's throw some words on the screen. Hey, let's show a rocket taking off. And to not use it more, I guess, through the film, evenly, and those two things are just kind of like, I could kind of do without that.
So I would say I definitely noticed those things. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, it didn't bother me. But as soon as I saw it, I said, this is going to bother somebody.
Yeah, it bothered me. And the one that really, I could deal with the rocket one. That'd just be weird.
Really?
That'd be a little like psychedelic moment.
he planned it.
The one that bothered me was throwing the Dylan lyrics up on the wall mm-hmm. in the film when you just quoted the lyrics mm-hmm. for us all to hear. And so like, it was just like this double, like, I really want you to get this. Like, you know, like, let me slowly take your hand and walk you through. It's like, I get it. You don't have to, you know, you just said that.
Mm. Well, so I really enjoyed this movie. And
like I'm glad you did. I think that this kind of movie for someone like you, Fizz, could really work to encourage you to, you know, explore the real Steve and check out some better biography material and so forth.
Someone like me.
Someone like you.
Someone like me.
Muggles.
I can hear your judgy eyes, Joe.
So you know the unenlightened.
Yes.
The eye
maybe
muggles.
One day.
Yeah.
gosh, Joe. So since I enjoyed this, despite my muggleness.
Because you know, Apple stuff is all magical.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, how else could it? How could they get so much power in such a small device? Not because of science. Oh gosh! So I feel like most of the things I want to critique about this film mm-hmm. are things that I don't have baggage for.
Hmm.
So when I was thinking about what did bother me, I was thinking that it was actually pretty hard to figure out something that I didn't enjoy about this film, and I came back to something. As much as I enjoy Aaron Sorkin's writing. Like I would say 90% of the time,
mm-hmm.
there was this thing that Sorkin does sometimes when I feel like he gets a little carried away or ahead of himself and it gets hard to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Jason, maybe you said something about this at a certain part of the film, but I kind of agreed. I don't know if it was the same part, but the part leading up to the voting scene in Act 2,
mm-hmm.
like understanding who was calling for what,
yeah.
and him and Jeff Daniels went back and forth so quickly. And I guess I just don't understand how CEOs and boards and things like that work well enough to mm-hmm. have just translated that in my mind. And eventually I caught up, like, sure. We stayed in that moment long enough to where it wasn't a mystery when everything was done.
Yeah.
But I was like, okay, what's going on? Yeah.
I felt that way about the first, when we were in the car, the first third of the movie
mm-hmm.
was really rough for me.
Mm.
And I will say, I'm going to go back and see it again just because I like Steve Jobs, I like Sorkin.
Yeah.
But I really want to see if that was just me getting accustomed to it or mm-hmm. whether the first third of the movie really was a lot looser and not as mm-hmm. tight as it could have been. I feel like it got its legs in that second and third act
mm.
and was humming along nicely.
Well, so even then, like I said, it's a slight. Mm-hmm. It was a slight. Well, it didn't make me say come on. I was just kind of like, huh?
I believe the script was 182 or 190 pages that Sorkin wrote, and so that's a lot of dialogue.
That's a lot of dialogue.
Yeah.
Especially since like his pages aren't like, mm-hmm. you know, like guy goes over here
and looks introspectively at himself.
Yeah, it's like you just wrote a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So okay, so we end by like ending on a high note,
okay,
which should be easy for this movie because I think we all enjoyed it to some degree, even me people. So Joe, what was your favorite part of this movie?
I would say that it has a lot to do with the style of visuals that. Through and through, it felt true to the different eras of Apple mm-hmm. design styles. Mm-hmm. So what we saw when backstage they were messing with the 84 Macintosh, it felt true to what that Macintosh represented, like design-wise spiritually. And then when you get into the iMac era backstage, things that they just did with the rooms themselves, the way they colored things, the panels, the lighting, the materials, mm-hmm. they kind of became like everything became an offshoot of the design trend of the time that was going on in mm-hmm. Apple corporately. And it was interesting how everything in the room and beyond started to reflect Apple of those eras and the next computer mm-hmm. era. I just enjoyed it. It was kind of classy sort of way to artistically represent these moments. You know, so when you're dealing with Next, there was a lot of black. And, you know, because mm-hmm. the black mm-hmm. cube that Next was building. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was clever as a creative license choice.
No, it was great. It was very thematically appropriate. Mm-hmm. I was surprised at how everything kind of tied together. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we see that in film very often.
Yeah.
So, Jason, what was your favorite?
I think I really like the way, because when I first heard about the movie, I was reading interviews with Sorkin. He's mm-hmm. like, I got the script, I'm writing it. He said, essentially, I'm going to do three acts. Mm-hmm. My first thought was, how in the world? Like, it's just going to be so cool. Like, how are you going to, he's revealing products.
Yeah.
And then, as you know, I hope this isn't stealing any of your thunder, Mikey, but we never actually see the products.
Yeah.
So, like, they pan away. That's obviously very intentional. I like that, but I also liked in the backdrop, they did kind of cut away to these other scenes, whether it was seeing mm-hmm. Steve Jobs' actual biological father in a restaurant explaining kind of the key scene where Jobs sells Scully to come to Apple in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, this famous line, you know, you don't want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, do you? Mm-hmm. So I liked how like they incorporated these other moments to keep the narrative together, because that was a big question I had going in, is just how are you going to do this?
Yeah.
So I really thought that was just brilliant on Sorkin's part mm-hmm. of doing that. And as always, I just love Sorkin. So I thought the script was great. I thought the acting was great. Mm-hmm. And I was really impressed with Kate Winslet's character. Mm-hmm. I thought she did a remarkable job playing Joanna Huffman. And then I was actually really impressed with Seth Rogen. Mm-hmm. I was actually, when I heard he was cast, I thought, oh no, we've done like a Ashton Kutcher, Steve Jobs thing all over again. but I thought Rogen did a great job kind of being that character. And he wasn't distracting in the least. Mm. So I thought that, the acting, the script, all of it was phenomenal.
Well, I agree with you, because you are stealing a little bit of my thunder, which is completely fine, because it's cool for people to like the same things.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons I usually use the what's your, mm-hmm. When I do a live event mm-hmm. for Real World, one of the first questions I ask mm-hmm. is like, what was your favorite part?
Yeah.
Because I think if lots mm-hmm. of people connect to the same part,
yeah.
we're all connecting to maybe like a bigger truth that we need to explore.
Sure.
And, not that that's necessarily the case in this case, but I think mm-hmm. more to say, it makes sense that people are going to like the same things.
Yeah.
And I was going to have this quick bullet list mm-hmm. of things before I got to my favorite scene, but I think you hit on most of it. The mm-hmm. fact that it was broken into three acts mm-hmm. and something that Joe said, that they were all done mm-hmm. in different styles that reflected kind of Apple at the time. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that almost every one of those acts was centered around a product launch mm-hmm. and we didn't see the product launch and it didn't matter. Was, I thought, brilliant. Michael Fassbender, brilliant. Mm-hmm. Seth Rogen, I thought, was brilliant. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that he like doesn't just have to make like fart movies all the time. even though occasionally like some of them aren't bad, mm-hmm. but I think I was telling, maybe it was you I was telling, it was like, you know, it's like one in five movies, like he kind of actually does something that's worth seeing.
Yeah.
I just wish you would stick to those one in five, but
a broken clock is right.
Yeah.
Twice a day.
Yeah. So, so that would be like my bullet list, but, and I'm surprised you didn't mention this, cause I feel like this is still your thunder, Jason, okay, based on our conversation right after
I'm
the movie.
I'm going to give back some thunder.
Oh, yeah. take some. My favorite scene, I think, was the one that you pointed out, mm-hmm. which is because it does so much characterization mm-hmm. in this conversation that happens when Steve and Steve are mm-hmm. sitting there
yeah.
in the orchestra pit. And Wozniak's showing mm-hmm. Jobs his watch.
Yes.
And he's yeah. like, this is going to be yes. big.
That was
I love that scene.
Yeah, and he's just showing it to him. And, you know, Steve yeah. Jobs is like, show me how it works.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, it's real easy. And he's taking parts off and he's messing with his tool. And he's like, sir, like someone's setting off a bomb. Yeah, you know?
A plane.
He's like, no, they'll get used to it. He's like, no.
Nope.
You know, just it completely yeah. shows their two perspectives.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, like function over mm-hmm. form, and mm-hmm. people will just never be able to get
it. It's a great homage to where Apple went.
Yeah.
You know, with
yeah.
the watch. Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. I thought that, like I said, it captured so much mm-hmm. of the spirit of the film.
Yeah.
And what I think Sorkin was trying to do, mm-hmm. what trying to show.
Yeah.
You know, like neither of them, like Wozniak wasn't an idiot for liking the watch.
Yeah.
Wozniak wasn't unfunctional
yeah.
in liking the watch.
Yeah.
But
without Jobs, it was incomplete.
But yeah. without Jobs, it was, yeah. you know, whatever. So it showed both their visions. It showed, because it showed neither of them wrong.
Yeah.
It just showed them different.
They both bring different things to the table.
Yeah. And so I thought that was great. And you did it in like a, you know, a 1 minute conversation.
Yeah.
Like I said, before I let my guests tell you how you can continue them, I just wanted to say that, like, it really was one of the finer films that I've seen mm-hmm. all year. As usual, I want to caution people. There's lots of language and things
sure.
in the
yeah.
film.
So, it is rated R.
You know, yeah. it is rated R. I think rightfully so, yeah. Based on language and content. Mm-hmm. But I totally get why some Jobs devotees wouldn't like it. But I really, it's hard for me not to recommend this film pretty mm-hmm. highly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great conversation yeah. starter. Like I said, we've only scratched the surface. Mm-hmm. So if you want to continue that conversation or pick up on something, you know, Jason, you've already mentioned, like, we haven't even talked about the influence of Dylan, anything like that. So if you're out there, you love Steve Jobs or you love this movie or it just sparked something inside of you and you want to continue chatting with these fine fellas, Joe, how can people find what you do or continue the conversation?
Thank you for asking. If you want to talk to me, follow me, whatever, on the internets, I'm _ Joe Darnell on Twitter. And that's how you get to me. If you want to get to my podcasts, one of these days, listen to them. They are completely unrelated to movies. I'll warn you, but they are fun. I like to have cool people on them, just like Fizz has on his podcast. So we have Tectonic. That's a play on words. Tectonic.fm is the website. And then the other website and podcast, it's Top Brew. And that's a podcast about coffee.
Well, I'm going to say, Joe, I really don't want you to sell yourself short here, because if I was doing a demographic thing mm-hmm. about who would listen to an episode about a film about Steve
That's
Jobs,
true. Yeah.
my guess
is
that most of those people would be into technology and coffee. So maybe not about films, Joe,
maybe
but
not.
I think you're right up the alley for the people who would be into this. So if those things appeal to you, check out Joe's stuff. And Jason, is there a way that people can interact with you? Or
yeah, I'm on obviously the Facebook and the Instagram,
the social network,
and on Twitter at jmyers1018.
I don't actually think I'm following you on Twitter.
Well, I just gained a follower.
So we'll make sure you do that.
That's where you can find me, or you can stumble into a classroom somewhere here in North
or
Carolina.
You can sign up
yeah.
for classes at Greensboro
exactly.
College.
You're a lot more of me.
It's probably going to be a lot cheaper to talk
to watch the podcast.
Well, great. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, we've got lots of ways for you to do that. iTunes, Stitcher, Feedburner, blah, 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 blah. We're so grateful for our excellent guests. Please follow them on social media or show up in their classroom, whatever. Meanwhile, we're thankful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
One more thing. Thank you.
Jason.
Yes.
Joe is obviously, by his subtle boasting, I mean, I think you caught it in there. He is a person who has podcasted a number of times.
Which I come in on the opposite end because this is my very first.
Awesome.
Exactly. But you'll get the podcast bug because it's cool. Like getting a tattoo. Like once you do your first one, like I said, there have already been two people who I've had on this show.
Yeah.
For their first episode, like their first podcast ever.
Yeah.
And now one of them has a podcast that's, I mean, many episodes in, fairly well known. Mm. And another one is about to start his own podcast.
Interesting.
And so, like, you know, this might be something that this is just the precursor. Yeah. This is the prequel.
It's like an incubator.
Yeah. Even
like an incubator.
That's for what podcasting. I am. And apparently, origin stories all began. We make $0. This is how everyone was born.
So, what did I sign on the way in?
Yeah. That was... you don't. That's just. I mean, it's standard.
Oh yeah.
10%. You know. So.
Yeah, I also keep 10%. You told me like that's everyone. They keep 10%.
Well, see, I feel like you could relate to this because I'm like the teacher in this scenario. You know, like I'm going to hopefully shape and cultivate young minds or older minds. It doesn't matter. Minds at large, and they will go on to do great and wonderful things. And everyone will say, "Well, if you were so great and wonderful, why didn't you do the thing instead of teach?" Yeah. And I was like, somebody's got to teach, you know, somebody's got to have a passion to, you know, pave the way for these other people.
Spur your young minds in the
and thought. Then take 10% off the top.
Exactly. And sit back and watch it roll. And...
You know, because those who can do and those who can't podcast.
Easy money.
Easy money. Easiest money.